Everybody, so it is a pleasure to be learning with everybody. We've been continuing on this journey together through the thought of Rabbi Sacks, and today we're going to be discussing a very interesting idea, a very interesting thought, which is called Judaism, a religion or a nation, a very complex question. Beforehand, I'd like to start to thank Moshe and Liora Berg, who are sponsoring in celebration of Paul Weinberg's Aliyah this week. Be'ezra Hashem, it should be b'shah tov v'mitzlachas. What a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful moment. We should all be following you. Be'ezrat Hashem, shavu bonim. Be'ezrat Hashem. Also, today is just marking the yahrzeit of Label's father, Yerucham Noam Ben, Reb Aryeh Leib. Mitzvah Hashem nishmosoi eden. So, let's start this topic. These topics are all just unbelievably incredible. I'm sorry, I'm not advertising myself. I'm just saying it happens. The topics are incredible. So let's try to do a little bit of thought together in this topic. So, Judaism, a religion or a nation, is a question which has plagued us for centuries. And it's a very hard question to answer for a number of reasons. Reason number one is that we have the trappings of both and the trappings of neither at the same time. On the one hand, you know, Jews do seem to be a religion. But if you're to measure Jews by the yardstick of religion, well, I don't know if you've been doing any reading recently, but they don't seem to all be agreeing on the same religious principles. Necessarily. So if you define them as a religion, then which religion? Is there any sort of, you know, how loose is that belt to hold us all together necessarily? So you say, well, no, we're a nation, but then we are lacking the trappings, the regular trappings of nationhood. So we don't have a political, well, up till very recently, Jews have not had a political state. Jews have not had common languages, common countries. So what makes us? So you say, well, there's Israel, the state of Israel today. But to be honest, about half of world Jewry is still not in the state of Israel. So is it a nation? It's interesting that if you go through the centuries, Jews have had to work through this. There's been times in history where perhaps it seems more like a nation, times in history seems more like a religion, or a little bit of a both, a dichotomy of both. It's interesting. In an interesting point, Rabbi Sacks points out, this is such a brilliant assessment, in the 1800s, when nationalism was on the rise, every country was becoming proud of their identity, that was actually what yielded the reform movement. What a brilliant insight. That means to say that the reason why the reform movement came into being was because in question was, are you a Frenchman or are you a German more than are you a Jew? Because that was what nationalism was asking. And in response to that, reform said, be a Jew in the home, and a Frenchman in the street. That's essentially what the answer they gave to this was, which further fractured the identity of who is a Jew, what is a Jew, what binds us all together. That was one of the many challenges that Judaism has experienced through the last 2,600 years in trying to maintain their identity. So what we're going to do is I'd like to explore a thought path, which is, I would say, a remarkable thought path in the coming few minutes. And it's going to take us through three different essays, three different ideas. The final one being In Future Tense, which is a book Rabbi Sacks published in 2011 towards the end of his career as a chief rabbi, which pulls together two other theories from earlier I led in the scroll, which was in the year 2000, and To Heal a Fractured World in 2005. So taking two ideas, converging them into one perspective. So that's what our goal is today. I'm going to interrupt myself just to wish a very special mazel tov to Yitzhak Moskowitz on Racheli's engagement this last week. Be'ezra Hashem, what a wonderful, wonderful thing. To Eli Shram, Be'ezra Hashem, the wedding should be b'shar tov mitzlachas. Wonderful, wonderful news. So let's start at the beginning. So Rabbi Sacks points out, this should be an obvious point, but not people don't necessarily pick up on this, is that how many times were the Jewish people exiled? Now, in Europe, you can count multiple times, but from their land. So in Europe, almost every country had its time. But but in terms of actually from the state, from the land of Israel, there were three times that the nation of Israel were exiled. Yes, in thought we talk about the four Goliaths, the four exiles, but technically speaking, some of those were simply transfers in power rather than actual exiles. So really the three times that it occurred was when as tribes, as individuals, we, the nation, the brothers of Yosef and Yaakov, we left the land of Israel for Egypt, becoming almost a metaphor for all other exiles. The next time was as a nation, as Yisrael, B'nai Yisrael, literally. The next time was the goddess Babel, and the last time was goddess Edom, was Rome. The in-betweens were simply transfers of power. So Persia and Greece were simply who was the overlord in the land of Israel. But we weren't exiled from the land of Israel necessarily, as an example. So if you look at all three of them, they share one item in common, one idea in common. And I actually spoke about this on Tisha B'Av this year. But that is that when you look at the common thread between all three of them, we know that by the exile of the brothers of Yosef to Egypt, it was as a function of discord between the brothers. We're going to learn in a short order. That his brothers hated him, his father favored him, they couldn't speak to him in peace. And yes, maybe that's a positive thing because their piv v'lib are shavim, their mouths and their hearts were the same. But at the end of the day, that's what led to them selling him, the sale ultimately led to him rising in rank in the Egyptian government and ultimately bringing them down. Now, yes, it was a kind option, but the Gemara in Sota points out that there was another option that could have been that they were all taken down in Egypt in chains. But Hashem pulled them down to Egypt in chains of love. No, the love of a father for a son. But be it as it may, it stemmed from infighting. Come to the Babylonian exile. The Babylonian exile actually started really towards the beginning of the first base of Migdash, where what happened was is the second, or really certainly the fourth king of Israel, but the second in the line of David, third the king of Israel, the fourth king, Rechavam, the son of Shlomo, the son of David, assumes the reins of ruler. And he is not like his father. He doesn't have the experience or the charisma or the gravitas yet to govern. And the people take advantage of this and they ask for a tax break because Shlomo Melech has taxed the people to the extreme. The reason is because he builds the Beis HaMikdash. So they come to him and they ask for a tax break. And Rechavam, being a young man, he was in his 40s at this time, but young in terms of experience, turns to his advisors. The elderly advisors say, give the people a break. And the younger ones say, no, ratchet it up. You show them who's boss here. And so when experiencing this difference in opinion, he tilts towards the young advice and he ratchets up taxes and thereby creating an economic dysfunction or economic distress enough for dissidents like Yerovam ben Nevot to step in and say, you see, I told you, he doesn't really care about you. Yerovam takes he kills the tax collector of Rechavam, splits the kingdom into two, and from there on inwards, during the reign of the second base of Migdash, we have a split kingdom. That split kingdom is going to always be, there's going to be civil wars. Hundreds of thousands of people will die because of this. Israelites on both sides, Judeans and Israelites. Ultimately, that's going to be that the 10 tribes are going to be exiled in part by the Assyrians first, and the Assyrians are going to lay siege to the Judea, and the remaining vestige of the state of Judea is finally going to be exiled by Babylon. But it started with fighting again, ourselves with ourselves. It happens to be the same fighting. It was Yehuda and Yosef, really. Rehoboam and Rechavam, the same. It starts in the same place. And if you go further than that, and ultimately it comes down to Yirmiyahu trying to tell them to do one thing, and they're not interested in doing that, and they're imprisoning Yirmiyahu and enslaving each other. I mean, fighting till the very last point. Fighting till the very last point, unfortunately. You come down to fast forward to the third base of Migdash. So the second base of Migdash. Lahavdil, in description of what was going on there, I mean, you just have to do a little bit of reading. Dr. Abramson actually gave a lecture this last Tisha B'Av on it. It's just so incredibly sobering of what was going on in Jerusalem. The Purushim, that's the folks that we're descended from, already left Jerusalem because of the infighting between the Sicarii and the Zealots and all the different factions who are killing each other in Jerusalem. And in Josephus' words in the Jewish war, he says, to whichever part of the city John turned, he never failed to set fire to the houses that were stocked with corn and kinds of supplies. And when he withdrew, Simon advanced into the same. So John and Simon were two different Jews who were fighting for control over Jerusalem internally while the Romans were besieging them on the outside. And they were just basically taking over and destroying each other's areas. Now, Jerusalem's not an awfully large city, right? But this is what was happening. It was as if to oblige the Romans that they were destroying all that the city had laid up against the siege and severing the sinews of their own strength. The Gemara in Gittin talks about this and talks about the Biryonim who are burning down the supply houses. It doesn't mean to say, right, an external. It's Jews fighting Jews in the city. The result, at any rate, was that all the buildings around the temple were reduced to ashes. The city became a desolate no man's land for their domestic warfare, and almost all the grain enough to support them through the years of siege went up in flames. It was famine that defeated them, a thing that could never have happened if they had not brought it upon themselves. That's the Jewish legacy. That the three greatest exiles from the land of Israel were brought upon by Jews themselves. And this is my particular topic or lecture on this topic was called The Worst Enemy of the Jews, which turns out to usually be the Jews. And so this is the hallmark of each of these exiles. Yes, there were people on the outside, but we exacerbated the situation to the point of destruction. In fact, there's an interesting read in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. You know the famous Mishnah, the third parak of Pirkei Avos, says, Rabbi Chanina ben Skana Kohanim Omer, having spelled with Shlomo Shel Malchus, Shel Malei Mora'o, Ish Esra'eyu, Chaim Bela'oi, that you should pray for the welfare of the government, because without its fear, people would swallow each other alive. What does that mean exactly? So Rabbi Chanina Sagana Kohanim lived at the times of the Romans. What government was he talking about? The Romans. And think about, therefore, the irony, the dramatic irony. What he's saying is perhaps, this is one way of reading the Mishnah, is pray for the Roman government, because who's going to swallow each other alive? Us. Pray for the Romans so the Jews don't kill the Jews. That's a sad state of affairs. That's a very sad state of affairs, and it hasn't changed too much. Mm-hmm. Think about how much we fight with each other. So what our Sachs's observation is, and this is such an incredibly profound observation about Jewish history, in future tense, he says the following. He quotes Jean-Jacques Rousseau in an unpublished note that was found. This is to be found in a library. It's not published. But an astonishing and truly unique spectacle to see an expatriated people who have had neither place nor land for nearly 2,000 years, a people mingled with foreigners, no longer people having a single descendant of the early races, a scattered people dispersed over the world, enslaved, persecuted, scorned by all the nations, nonetheless preserving its characteristics, its laws, its customs, its patriotic love of the early social union, and with all the ties with it seem broken. They mingle with all the nations and never merge with them. And they no longer have leaders, they are still a nation. They no longer have a homeland, they are always citizens of it. Beautiful observation from the outside. And this is our Sachs's observation. This is the paradox. In their own land, the place of every other nation is to some degree united. Jews were split beyond repair. In dispersion, where every other nation had assimilated and disappeared, they remain distinctive and, in essentials, at least united. There is something surpassingly strange about Jewish peoplehood. Is that a remarkable observation? We simply cannot get along together in one country like regular nations. But then we're thrown around the world and we somehow seem to just survive. How does that? It's an unbelievable paradox about the Jewish people. So what is it? How do we define it? How do we understand where this comes from? So actually, what is interesting is that Rav Sachs takes an observation from Rav Soloveitchik, an observation that was made by Rav Soloveitchik in Kol Dodi Dofek, which was a lecture he gave in Lamport Auditorium in 1956, which was later written down, of course, in the original language it was given, which is Yiddish. And then it was later translated into Hebrew and into English. And if you haven't read it, then you're missing a part of your Judaism. So it's very important to read Kol Dodi Dofek. But he essentially builds off this. And I want to just take a moment as a sidestep, just because I do need to get it off my chest. And that is that Rav Sachs was such an incredibly large figure in the Jewish world. He was such a spokesperson for the Jewish nation in so many ways. So a lot of people like to take credit for it. So if you speak to anybody from Chabad, they'll say, Rav Sachs was, of course, Chabad, because the Lubavitcher Rebbe influenced him heavily. And that's true. He came to America, and he met two great leaders. And those great leaders were Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Soloveitchik. And when reflecting upon it, he said, the Lubavitcher Rebbe taught me how to lead, and Rav Soloveitchik taught me how to think, just to clarify. And so it is true that 10 years ago he spoke at the Kinos HaShulchan, and it was remarkable. And he references the Lubavitcher Rebbe numerous times. He quotes of the Lubavitcher Rebbe saying, great leaders don't create followers, great leaders create great leaders. That's what he said of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he was very deeply influenced by the Lubavitcher Rebbe. However, it is not true that Rav Sachs was only influenced by Chabad. It's just important to reach out this. When he came back to America after his tenure as the Chief Rabbi of England, he came to teach in YU. Right, so it's just important to appreciate the influence, and nobody has a trademark on Rabbi Sachs. And sometimes when I have these conversations, it feels like it's as if everybody owns. No, nobody owns him. He was his own distinct human being who was influenced by many great thinkers. So here is his idea, his interpretation of the thought of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik has an essay called Kol Dodi Dofek, has multiple different parts. He talks about the Holocaust. He talks about the birth of Israel. He talks about nationhood. These are very important topics, which are still relevant today, many, many decades later. Let's start with the following part, the following place. When Ruth is trying to convert to the religion of her mother-in-law tries to dissuade her. And she says the very famous words, words which will resonate throughout history. Vatomer Rus in Psalm 6, El Altif Giibi, do no longer force me away, ki lo azvech lo shuv me'acharayach, to leave me, to make me go back. Ki el asher telchi eilech, uvasher tolini alin, amech ami velohayech elohai. Wherever you go, I'm going to go. Wherever you sleep, I will sleep. Where your nation is my nation and your God is my God. What essentially, if you think about this, she's talking about two different currencies in this. The one is practice, and the one is peoplehood, nationhood. Do you notice that? Going and sleeping is your practices. I will practice like you. But I'm not going to just practice like you. I'm going to be you. Similarly, when we learn the halachas of Geirus out of many places, including Rus, the Gemara in Yevamos tells us that one, there are a number of things that we tell, and still today, to prospective people who are converting. Tana Rabban, the Gemara says in Yevamos, Ker shebol yiskayer bizman hazeh, aymrim lai, maroy shebol yiskayer. Why is it that you want to convert? Yato yodeh sheYisrael bizman hazeh, dvuyim, dechuvim, sechuvim, muturavim, v'yisurim, boim aleihem. It's so true, it hasn't changed, right? The Jews are in anguish, suppressed, despised, harassed, people who had hardships come upon them. If the person says, I know, but I'm unworthy, meaning I still want to join, then you accept that person immediately. The next question, in the next page, There's all these mitzvahs. Judaism is full of details. And there's going to be leket and shichicha and peah. There's going to be tzedakah and there's going to be Shabbos. And you know what? In the previous days, on Saturday, you could go to the ball game. There'd be no capital punishment. You're a Jew and that's what happens. Do you really want this? So again, what do you see? Two different strands. Practice and nationhood. Being and practice. What essentially is that Judaism, in a sense, is two different things at once. It's Ba'asher Toluni Alin, it's the practices, but it's also Amech Ami at the same time. The way Rav Soloveitchik says this is that there were two covenants formed with Israel, two Britot, two natural covenants. Number one was when we left Egypt. This is what he calls the covenant of fate. The covenant of fate is we became a nation under God. But then there's the covenant of destiny. That was at Har Sinai, 50 days later, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, it's not enough just to be a people, you need to be a people who follow me. In the Rav Soloveitchik's own words, in Kol Dodi Dofek, in the source 8, we're going to go to the second and third paragraph. What is the covenant of fate? Fate signifies in the life of a nation, as it does the life of the individual, an existence of compulsion. A strange force merges all individuals into one unit. The individual is subject and subjugated against his will to the national fate of existence, and it is impossible for him to avoid it and be absorbed into a different reality. The environment expels the Jew who flees from the presence of God, so that he is awakened from his slumber like Jonah the prophet, who awoke to the voice of the ship's captain demanding to know his personal national religious identity. We are all Jonah at certain points where we're woken up and that question is asked of us. Rav Soloveitchik, it's such a beautiful section, but he has another line which I did not put in here, which is just so profound. He says, a Jew cannot expel the God of the Hebrews from his private domain. Even if he violates the Sabbath, defiles his table and his bed, and strives to deny his own Jewishness, his membership in the Jewish people, he will still not be able to escape the dominion of the God in the Hebrews, who pursues him like a shadow. So long as a person's nose testifies to his origins, so long as a drop of Jewish blood courses through his veins, so long as he is physically, he is still a Jew. He serves the God of the Hebrews against his will. That's the covenant of faith. You're Jewish, and you want to forget it? They're not going to forget it. That's what Rav Soloveitchik points out. That's the covenant of faith. That's the, we'll call it the nationhood, the national Jew. Then there's the covenant of destiny. Coming back to the second paragraph on the bottom of page 5. What is the covenant of destiny? In the life of the people, as in the life of the individual, destiny signifies an existence that is that it has chosen of its own free will. Notice that we did not choose to leave Mitzrayim, but we did choose Matan Torah, Na'aseh V'Nishma, and with which it finds the full realization of its historical existence. Instead of a passive, inexorable existence into which a nation is thrust, an existence of destiny manifests itself in the act of experience full of purposeful movement, ascension, aspirations, and fulfillment. Imagine this in Yiddish, by the way. It's magnificent. The nation is enmeshed in its destiny because of its longing for an enhanced state of being, an existence replete with a substance and direction. Destiny is the font out of which flow the unique self-elevation of the nation, an unending stream of divine inspiration that it will not run so long dry so long as the path of the people is demarcated by the laws of God. The life of destiny is direct, a directed life, the result of a conscious direction and free will. Meaning, when we moved out of Egypt, we weren't accepting anything. We were thrust into being a people as opposed to slaves in another country. But we didn't choose, and there were no laws. That happened 50 days later, where we made the choice to accept the laws, the destiny to freedom to, not just freedom from. That's what we ultimately chose. That's the two aspects, and those actually accompany us throughout history. That's what Rus is saying to her mother-in-law: I'm going to sleep where you sleep, but I'm also going to be your nation. And that's why we said to the Ger, remember that the Jews are persecuted, that's nationhood, and remember that there's the halachas, those are the laws, that's the covenant of destiny. That's what Rav Soloveitchik is arguing. Let's take it one step further. According to Rav Soloveitchik, these two exist in a certain sense as separate ideas. They can be actually at the same time, and they can be perhaps separated from each other. Rav Sacks argues on Rav Soloveitchik's idea and says the following. This is the brilliance of what Rav Sacks is arguing. We could disagree with this, but listen to this observation. He says the following in Source 9, at the second paragraph. Without the covenant of faith, there is no covenant of fate. Without religion, there is no global nation. The story of Jewish survival through a catastrophe turned on two critical moments in history, one that led to an institution, the other to an idea. It is not too much to say that between them they saved the Jewish peoplehood, and that's the Jewish people. Both were achievements of the Spirit, for Jews are people of the Spirit, and without that, they are not a people at all. So his argument is that without the religion, right, without the call of covenant of destiny, the covenant of fate falls apart. If you don't have halacha, if you don't have Torah, then actually the notion of being a nation itself falls flat. Let's try to unpack that and why that is. So his argument is that there are two tools that were created in order to ensure the covenant of faith continues. What were those? What were those two institutions? One is a physical institution of ideas, and the other one is essentially a framework. So the first is what he calls the notion of the synagogue, and we take the shul for granted, right? We even walk away from it from time to time, but to understand the profundity of the creation of the shul, here's the way that Yechezkel puts it. Yechezkel is one of the Jews who was exiled before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. He's living in Babylon. He's got brothers and friends who are sitting on the Nar Kvar up there in Babylon, witnessing and hearing the reports from Israel as the painful and excruciating destruction is happening. And he says in Perek Yud Aleph, the top of the page 7, he says, "Lochein emor kamar Hashem Elokim ki yirchaktim ba'goyim v'lechi hafitzoisim ba'aratzois." As I destroyed them from their country, and I scattered them among the nations, "V'o'ei lohem lemikdash ma'at ba'aratzois asher bo sham." I will be to them as a small mikdash, a small sanctuary. That's where I'll be there. Which is remarkable, because you think, how can that even possibly be? You have a Beis HaMikdash, you have the Avodah, you have the Korbanos, you have the Avodas Yom HaKippurim, you have all these. That's an irreplaceable value. It's an irreplaceable asset. There's no way that Judaism can continue without that. Says Yechezkel, in the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, yes, I'm going to create a place where every Jew can come and daven. I'm going to create a place where every person can meet Hashem on their own terms, not at fixed times of the day necessarily, even that. I'm going to be able to create the way that every person has the ability to connect with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In fact, this is what essentially the Medrash is arguing in Vayikra. This the Medrash Rabbah in Vayikra Rabbah. It says, "Tani Chizkiah, se pezuri Yisrael, nimshulu Yisrael se." Israel, as Jeremiah says, as Jeremiah says, is like this wayward lamb among the nations. Masse azel loike al roishoy oy be'echad me'evorav kol evorav margishin kachem Yisrael. When a lamb is beaten and it's bruised on its leg, the whole lamb, it feels the pain. When that lamb is hurt, the one limb is hurt, all of the Jews feel it. And that's what the pasuk says. If one person sins, everybody else will suffer. Tani, well, that's actually by Korach, that he is arguing that should not be in that case. That's the exception. Tani Rabbi Yishimon Bar Yochai, Moshe Livnei Adam Shayu Yoshim B'Sfina. So imagine you have two people on a boat, or more people on a boat. Not Echad Mehem Makdech V'Hiskil Kodach Tachtov. So one of them decides, you know, he's going to make a little bit of a, you know, a plug, a hole by his seat. What are you doing exactly? What is the drill in your hand for, sir? Says, I'm gonna take it, this is my seat. I'm entitled to do what I want underneath my seat. So the water is gonna submerge the whole boat. It's not just what you're doing. What the Midrash is essentially saying is HaKadosh Baruch Hu found a way that we feel this responsibility towards each other, that anything we do, how was that? Where was that institution? That was the Beis Knesset, where we all feel that we're not simply just living in these different diasporas. You can go to any place in the world and feel that connection. In future tense, the way he concludes is the following. The synagogue was a unique institution. Its origins are lost in the vagaries of time. But it was the first place in history made holy, not because it was built on a holy site or because sacrifices were offered there, but merely because people gathered there to study and pray. Where and when the synagogue as an institution was born is debated by scholars, but it was one of the most revolutionary of all Jewish innovations. It could be built anywhere that Jews gathered to study and pray. It was a reminder of the temple, a fragment of Jerusalem, a Jewish home in exile. It was, in the language of the internet, a virtual Jerusalem, a city of in cyberspace. Jews no longer physically had a land, but they had one in the mind. So one of the institutions which pulled us together, giving us, and essentially, so what is the kernel, what is the ingredient which pulls us all together? Here over here is the covenant of faith. We're moving away from the national structures, place that we own, sovereignty and political ownership. Now we have, we're in the back streets of wherever neighborhood, of whichever part of the world, in whichever ghetto, we can set up a place to pray. And that's what unites us as well. It reminds us of our shared responsibility. Actually, he has a chapter in a letter in the scroll on this topic, and I only found this afterwards, so I didn't put it into the notes, but just this comes back to that very interesting paradox he mentions at the beginning. Remember about how it is that we manage to keep together? So he quotes Rabbi Avigdor Amiel. Rav Amiel was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, okay, one of the great European Lithuanian Gedolim who came to was a Zionist, a religious Zionist, came to Israel, and he wrote many, many beautiful drashas called. Does anyone know what his drashas are? Drashas El Ami. That was how he chose his name, Amiel. He changed his name. So El Ami is to my nation. That's why his name is Amiel, right? So he wrote in his, and this is the quotation of the English translation: Jewry's weakness as a sovereign nation became its greatest strength in exile. Quite simply, the individual refused to bow to the majority. That is the hallmark of the Jew, right? That may have led to anarchy in Israel, but it led to obstinate faithfulness everywhere else. Isn't that brilliant? That's Rabbi Amiel's statement. If in Israel the Jews were ungovernable, in the diaspora they were unconquerable. And it was there that they created some of the greatest innovations known to man. So to follow up in one last quotation about the synagogue. The synagogue had the most profound political and spiritual consequences. It turned Jews from a people defined by its territory into the rarest of phenomena, a global nation. In effect, the synagogue, wherever it stood, was extraterritorial, much as embassies are today. Whether in Babylon or Bialystok, Romania or Rome, where whenever the Jews entered the house of prayer, they were in Israel, speaking its language, remembering its past, dreaming its future. That's what the synagogue was. That was a shul with pulling all the nation of Israel together. The covenant of faith actually is supplanting the covenant of fate, essentially, with his argument. Eliezer and then Abi, yeah.
I just want to add one thing. When the Pastor Shachter was here, they asked my question about coming back to shul. They asked Moshe Meir Weiss the same question this past week, and he said on this week's Pasha, He says, the Tzibur is the shul, and it's most important for everyone to come to David in the shul. Having Salamim and all these things, those are not the Tzibur. That's not the shul. It has to be a Beis Elokim.
And he has rehired. There you go. Abi.
Yeah, I have totally so during the period of the Maskinim, the Enlightenment, when it started, so their whole purpose was to remove ritual, to keep the essence of Judaism.
And did it succeed?
And to re- what that led to eventually.
Very good. So you're saying the opposite point, which is Rav Sacks is arguing that without the covenant of faith, without what pulls us together, which is essentially the example in space is the shul, which is a place where we, so to speak, speak the same language for once, which is Hebrew, with all the rest of the Jews in the world, whether I go to Portugal or whether I go to Spain or Morocco or South America, I'm speaking the same language in the shul, which unifies me as I'm part of Israel, which is essentially what Rav Sacks is saying. If you don't have that, then everything falls by the wayside within a generation or two, and we've seen that, unfortunately. Now, here's the most profound point. This is all of this was all just an introduction to get to this idea. So folks, if at this point in time we missed a few train stops, this is the point to focus on, because this is the most remarkable perspective. And here, this is an idea that Rabbi Sacks develops in both Tehillah, Fractured World, which is our first thought, and then later on in future tense. It is such a profound perspective. Here's the idea. The idea is the following, is that we have this notion of arvus, right? Arvus literally means, like, kol Yisrael arevim zebozeh, right? We say around the campfire, we're all friends, you know, we're all, and literally the word arev literally means responsible, guarantors, co-payers, right? So where does that come from? What is the makor? What is the source of that notion that we're all interconnected? Because this is very current for this conversation about peoplehood, nationhood, covenant of faith, covenant of fate. Where is the makor? What is the makor in Chazal for this? So Baruch Hashem, we have Yodei Sefer over here. So as Moshe points out, you go to Parshas Bechukosai, it's the most unimaginable place to find this idea. We talked about in the klados, in the curses of Parshas Bechukosai, the following description in source 13. Va'nisharim b'chem, Hashem, this is after wave of persecution and destruction as described when we don't listen to the will of God. Va'nisharim b'chem va'vesi morach bilvavchem, bilvavam, source 13. So Hashem says, those who remain, I'm going to put a fear in your hearts, ba'artzois oivehem, in the land of the enemies. Ve'radavosam kol ol enidof, and they'll be running paranoid from the sound of the leaf. And they'll run as if they're being pursued by the sword, and there's no one there. What a terrible tragedy! Something the Jews have felt everywhere. You know, I remember actually when our Sacks was here in our shul, he said that the certain generation, you know, when the traffic light would turn red, they would say it's anti-Semitic traffic lights, right? But there's a certain sense of paranoia as well that Jews experience because they've just been persecuted for so long. That's what the pasuk's saying is going to happen, and we've seen it. Then the apostle goes on. And we're going to run and trip over each other as if we're being pursued, as if there's a multitude after us, and there's no one behind us. And you will not be able to get up among your enemies. By the way, do you notice by the shift in third to second person there? Do you notice? The first pasuk is describing Israel from the outside. The second pasuk is talking directly to them. It's interesting to the change shift of voice. Worthwhile thinking about when learning the Torah as well. From this pasuk, each person will trip over their brother. Says the Sifra, the Midrash Halacha. This is the source. It doesn't say a person on his brother. The idea over here is, why does it say with the extra bays, is because each person will trip over the sin of their brother. Melamed shekol Yisrael arevim zebozeh. You see, all Jews are responsible for each other. And you think to yourself, that is such a strange place to learn this from. For a number of reasons. Let's just enumerate the questions. Number one, this is not a picture or a vision of responsibility. This is a vision of catastrophe, of chaos, of haphazard racing away from an enemy. How could this be seen as the place to describe this grand vision of interconnectedness and responsibility? It seems like the completely wrong place to learn it from. That's number one. Number two is that this notion of kol Yisrael arevim zebozeh, that all Jews are guarantors for one another, seems to be the basic assumption that governs most Torah principles. I mean, if you go to Sinai, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, you read in Parshas Nitzavim Vayelech, and you talk about Moshe Rabbeinu's covenant with Israel as they're about to enter into the land. Anisraelas Hashem Elokeinu Vaniglas Lanu Vonenu. It seems to me the assumption is that we all are responsible to each other, and if we sin, everybody else gets punished, and if we do well, everybody else does well. And if you look at the klalos and the brachos on Har Eval and Har Grizim, the basic assumption of Torah is that we're responsible for each other. There might be exceptions when, let's say, our nistarois, when it might be things that we don't know about that our brothers and sisters are doing, then we might have, there's a limitation when it comes to that. But when it comes to anything else which we have the right and responsibility to know about, we're responsible for whatever happens. I remember that I, when I was in fourth grade, what we call standard two, I came back, I was sick for a week. I don't remember what it was that I had. I came back from school straight into a detention for the whole class. Why? Because they'd done something to the substitute teacher. And I said, but I had nothing to do with that. I was sick the whole last week. And they said, well, you're going to learn a lesson that when you grow up, you understand that everybody's responsible for everybody else. Right? So that's how it works. Right? You're all responsible. We're all in the same. But that's a basic assumption. You could choose numerous other places in the Torah to learn this from. Why does the Sifra of all places choose this as a spot? So it turns out that just to appreciate the magnitude of this problem, we need to go back in history and understand the following. When we think about communal responsibility to one to another, we sometimes think of that as this religious principle, right? Of, you know, Kol Yisrael Ravim Zeh B'Zeh. But that's not necessarily true. In fact, communal responsibility is a basic moral principle in any society. A society which is bound by one of two things, either proximity or political sovereignty. What does that mean? Let's go through each of the two. So let's say proximity. So let's say we all live relatively close to each other. If I'm going to leave my garbage in the street, right, I can claim, like the person on the boat, that it's my seat. But at the end of the day, it's going to affect all of you because it's going to attract vermin. It's going to now make it harder to get through the street. It's going to now let down the moral standard that other people are going to do the same thing. And we're all going to pay for that. Right? So my actions naturally affect you. If I'm going to be a person who's going to make sure that I'm going to trim my grass with my nail clipper, you know, and it's going to be just perfect, that's going to also affect other people. It's going to affect the standing in the community. It's going to affect the property prices for everybody else. So proximity requires a certain level of moral culpability and responsibility for each other. That's basic. That's not religious. That's normal. Right? But let's say it's a little further afield. So let's say we're no longer talking about Lawrence or Cedarhurst as specific villages. Let's talk about the town of Hempstead, right? Which is a much larger entity. Or let's talk about the Nassau County that we're in as well. Well, if there's a political governance which unites us all, we pay taxes the same place, we have the same property assessments, not going there, right? But in the end of the day, what happens is that even though we may not live close to people who live at the other end of the county or the town, but in the end of the day, we share something because there's political sovereignty which governs us. That makes a lot of sense. That's everywhere you go in the world. And when it isn't working, we all suffer because of it. But here's the question. What happens when Judaism loses both of those? What happens when Judaism used to be, and the Torah prescribes that it lives in one place, we call that Israel, and that place has proximity and political sovereignty. What happens when that ends? What happens when that goes away? Is there now that responsibility in the place of that? In the words of, just to appreciate the significance of this question, later on in history, Spinoza, in the 1600s, Spinoza is the child of a converso family from Spain, expelled ultimately, and the conversos lived a very difficult identity. They were on the one hand distrusted by the Christians who had converted them, and distrusted by the Jews, who they still were somewhat connected to, and he was expelled, and part of his identity, and he, as a philosopher, he struggled with these things. He was excommunicated by the Jews in 1667, and later on in 1670 published his treatise on religion anonymously, and everybody thought it was heresy. At the time, it was one of the first people to suggest the separation of church and state. But what's fascinating is his observation about Judaism. He has his observation about Judaism. So the following. But with regard to the ceremonial observances which were ordained in the Old Testament for the Hebrews only, and were so adapted to their state that they could not for the most part be observed by society as a whole and not by each individual, it is evident they formed no part of the divine law and had nothing to do with the blessedness and virtue, but had reference only to the election of the Hebrews, that is, to their temporal bodily happiness and the tranquility of their kingdom, and therefore they were only valid while their kingdom lasted. What Spinoza was essentially saying regarding Judaism is Judaism was very nice and it all worked out when the vision that the Torah had given for it was in action, which is Jews living in Israel, governed by Torah law, therefore a nation. When that ended, so did Judaism essentially. When that ended, all of the Torah, which talks about being in a nation and bringing korbanos in a central location of a Beis HaMikdash, gone, up in smoke. It makes so much sense if you think about it, right? The we'll call plan A of the Torah is predominantly in the land of Israel. And he's saying, so what's afterwards? Where does that all disappear to? That was the crisis that he was describing. And by the way, he wasn't the first person. We learned last week a little bit about this when we talked about Jewish identity. In fact, in Yechezkel, I had the same question. People asked Yechezkel. We learned this last week. The pasuk in Perek Chof in Yechezkel. Spinoza was not the first person to ask this question. The Yechezkel says to the people, "V'ala al ruchachem halay lo siyeh." Asher atem amrim niye kagoyim k'mishpuchos haratzos l'sharis eves or even. The people of the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash says, what point is there still being Jewish? What were they asking? This is no longer what the Torah is talking about. There's no governing principle. We don't have proximity. We don't have national sovereignty. Is what the Torah was describing really relevant to us anymore? That's essentially what they were asking Yechezkel. He says, lo halayis lo siyeh, you're not going to be able to run away from it. That's what Yechezkel says, as we learned Abarbanel last week. But later on, the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash. The Gemara in Sanhedrin looked at this as well. Shmuel Amar, Bo Asar B'nei Adam Yoshe Lefanov, Amar Lein Chazru B'Tshuva. Turned people came in front of Shmuel, and he was talking to them about repenting, and he says, Amar Loi, Eved Shemarchu Rabbi V'Isha Shagir Shabayla, Klum Yesh B'Zeh Lo Zeh Al Zeh Klum. So the master sends out the slave. What? The slave has responsibility to the master? He's been thrown out. You think we as a nation, we as Jews, have anything to do with that HaKadosh Baruch Hu? That's the same question. The second time, the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash. So think about this for a second. This is a question which any thinking human being living through the destruction and there and right afterwards should be considering. After all, if you think about it, a majority of what the Torah talks about and the vision the Torah has is not possible in an exiled existence. And what's more is now looking back retrospectively at history, most of Jewish history has been in diaspora. So how does that work? How does the Torah expect us to live in this place? What governs us? What makes us us? Hang on, I just want to come to a climax here. So argues Rav Sacks, that's precisely why the specific spot that the Torah learns out the notion of arvus, of responsibility, is in the image of destruction. What the Torah is saying, what the Sifra is suggesting, is that you still bear responsibility one for another, even though you're tripping over each other, you still share each other's sins. Wait a second, I thought I had nothing to do with them. We're running from Israel. We no longer have anything to do with each other. No, precisely there is where the Torah is telling us. We'll call it, that's when it is necessary to tell us. Up till then, when Israel has been a sovereign nation, it's not necessary to tell us that we live and we're responsible for each other. That's because we live as a nation. What happens when we're shifting from the covenant of faith to the covenant of faith? And now the only thing that's going to hold us together is the strands of Torah, the strands of law. Well, are we still responsible for each other? Yes. The covenant of fate, what makes us a nation now, is our responsibility qua one another. That's what the brilliance of the Sifrois say. What an unbelievable notion. In the words of our Saxon covenant in future tense, the covenant of fate existed only because Jews were bound by a covenant of faith. That is the essential point. In Israel, Jews were a nation in a normal sense, bound together because they lived in the same land under the same government. Shared fate under such circumstances requires no special faith, no theology, no leap of the imagination. Outside Israel, however, only the covenant of faith sustained a covenant of fate. And only such a faith will, in the long run, keep the Jews together in a bond of mutual responsibility. Only this will sustain the attachment of of diaspora Jews to Israel. Brilliant. Brilliant idea. Yeah, Amy.
I mean, could we argue that when a nation, you know, dispersed, you know, they lose hope of ever returning, that we've never had that for us, when we dispersed, right, and whatever, our hope for 2,000 years was always that we've never lost that desire or that hope, and that's what keeps us as a nation throughout, you know, eternity. It just
hope is good, but it's more than that. That's what he's saying. It's not just hope. What the Sifra is essentially saying is that when I am going into exile and I'm going to Portugal and you're going to Romania, what I do and my sins are going to make you fail. That's what the Sifra is essentially saying. Why? I have nothing in common with you. I don't share a language. I don't share a nationality. I don't share a passport. I don't share anything. I don't share the Kenedelach. I don't share Gebrocks. Whatever it is, I have nothing else in common with you. Says the Sifra, I do. That's what the Sifra is arguing. I have this shared bond with you through the covenant of faith, through the Torah, which allows us to be one nation despite every other difference and trapping. That's the Chiddush. It's not just hope. Do you understand? It's the responsibility even in distance, even without proximity, even without religious sovereignty. Let's take one step further. In halacha and in spirituality, in Kabbalah. In halacha, this is a halacha, folks. This is the Gemara in Meseches Rosh Hashanah Daf Chav Tes Amud Av tells us the following very interesting halacha. The Gemara says, this is a halacha we do all the time. Today's daf. Fantastic. Today's daf. Thank you. Tani avo bereid derebi zera. Kol abrachos kulam av al pi sheyotza moitzi. If I've done a bracha, I can be moitzi you even though I've already done the bracha. What does that mean? So the Gemara limits this. Chutz mi birkas alecha mi birkas alayin shim lo yotza moitzi vim yotza en moitzi. If I've eaten a piece of my apple, and now I want to say a bereid for you, it's not going to work because... So it's my apple, right? Whereas, what are the brachas that a person can be moitzi another person or when already having done the bracha? What bracha are you referring to? What's called birkas hamitzvah, as Rashi says over here. That means to say why? What's the logic behind that? By the way, this happens all the time. If, let's say on a Friday night, a person hears Kiddush in shul, one of the arguments as to why a person can say Kiddush again at home is because there are people at home who have not heard Kiddush yet. So of course you can say Kiddush again, even though you may have been yotze, the mitzvah of Kiddush. Yotze, I have fulfilled my discharge of my obligation. Might see, I can might see others. Why? Says the Ritva. Ritva in source 21. Tani avar bereda rebizera. Pirush, kol abrochas hamitzvah. Kol birkas hamitzvah. It refers to the abrochas hamitzvah. Aval pi sheyotza moitzi, aval pi shehamitzvah is mutolos al kol echad, even though every mitzvah is incumbent upon each individual. Harei kol Yisrael arevim zebozeh, v'kulam keguv echad uka'arev haporea chaveroi. That we are all like one entity. What does that mean? That when I have come home from shul, and I have been yotze, the mitzvah, and so therefore, technically speaking, I've discharged my chiyuv, I can go to sleep right now. Now, the truth is that when there's somebody else who's not yet heard the mitzvah, and not yet discharged their chiyuv, I have a deficiency in my chiyuv, because I am their guarantor. And therefore, I'm allowed to and responsible to make the bracha on their behalf. That's how it works. That's how far this goes. And why does it not work when it comes to birkas hanenin, like eating? The answer is because my physical appetite and yours have nothing to do with each other. Yes, if we're sitting at the same table, I can say birkas hamotzi if we haven't all eaten together. But if I've already eaten, then my eating, your eating has nothing to do because physically speaking, we have no connection. Spiritually speaking, we're responsible for each other. That's precisely the point that Rav Sacks is saying. We may be, in the birkas hanenin side, I may have a different passport to you, but when it comes to the birkas hamitzvah, I am the same as you. And that's what the Yotza Moitzi is, based on the same principle. In spirituality, the Tanya says, the Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, in the 32nd parak, this is what's called, those who study Tanya, the Lev HaTanya, right, the heart of the Tanya, in the 53 prakim of the Ikutei HaMa'amorim, this is the one where he talks about V'avta L'recha Kamoicha, love of a fellow Jew. He makes the following brilliant observation. He says that although it is true that we seem very different to each other as individuals, the only reason why we see each other as different is because we have different bodies. We have different emotional frameworks. And therefore we relate to each other as different. But technically speaking, we actually really all are one. So how is that we come to a sense of communal love of each other is focusing less on the external trappings of the human being. Because that is what differentiates us, not unites us. Said in his own words in Source 22. Ki yesod v'shorash kol ha-Torah hi lagbia ulahalois ha-nefesh al-aguf. By identifying ourselves with our spirit, with our neshama, our spiritual side, more than our material side. So identity is not just who we are clothing in the morning, right? Ma'ale ma'ala, ascent upon ascent, ad ikara v'sharsha d'chol amin, as the root of all the worlds, v'gam na'amshich or ein sof baruch hu l'knesses Yisrael, thereby realizing that Hashem's light is upon all of us as Jews as one, k'mo shekos l'kam an d'hainu b'makor nishmas Yisrael, that we are really essentially united as one unit. Because there's no separation between the souls at the soul level. Hashem does not reside in a dented or a compromised place. Hashem's residing is in the spiritual realm where we're all united. It's just that we differentiate ourselves as we are in the physical realm. As you say, Borcheinu Avinu Kulanu Ke'echad Bo'or Panecha. When is it Hashem should bless us? When we're Kulanu Ke'echad, because that's where Hashem finds unity. when we're all together. But how do we find unity? When we stop focusing on our individuality. Where does our individuality stem from? Our materialism. Our materialism, therefore, is what separates us. That's the same idea. Are we the same? Yes, we are. It just sometimes we focus on the bottom end of the equation, which is the bodily unawareness. To conclude this this idea, in To Heal a Fractured World, Rav Sacks has points out the following, such a beautiful statement, source 23. The Torah survived as law of the Jewish nation because Jews continued to see themselves as a nation, even though they had lost all visible bases of nationhood. They did so because of the essentially mystical vision that even without sovereignty, outside the land of Israel and dispersed through the world, they remained a single body and a single soul, moved by one another's pain, sharing responsibility for their collective fate. More than any other factor, that belief preserved the Jewish nation through one of the deepest crises of its history and sustains us today. He describes in 1999, he as the chief rabbi of England, he went to Pristina. Anybody know where Pristina is? There we go. It's the whole Kosovo problem with Albanians. And if you remember back in the 90s, this was a terrible, terrible scar that was going on between initially the Christians who attacked the mosques in Albania, and then ultimately the reprisals, and NATO had to send their forces in, and there were tanks in the street to protect the citizens of this country. And at this point in time, he went to visit, and he described how Sir Michael Jackson, not the Michael Jackson that, you know, so Sir Michael Jackson, the commander of the NATO forces, said to him, "I want to thank the Jewish community, because the Jewish community took control of the 23 primary, or in America calls elementary schools, in this country." So he says, "Wow, that's remarkable." He says, "How many Jews live in Pristina?" So he said, 11. What had happened? When the crisis had happened and there was refugees, 800,000 people were refugees, moving around because of persecution from one side to the other, a terrible, terrible time. What had happened was that the NATO called upon the nations, and Israel, of course, had sent their task force in, called by some of the local Jews as well. And they realized that while everybody was focusing their efforts on the adults, one of the basic factors which makes a society normal is if the children have a place to go. This is during the summer. They set up camps for them. They set up woodworking, art shows for the kids. And ultimately, the Israeli team took control of the 23 primary schools over there. And Rabbi Sacks says, took this as a testament, first of all, to incredible Kiddush Hashem. But the fact that all it did was it took 11 Jews to mobilize a state of Israel to come and help school children who are primarily Muslim to be able to go back into their schools. That's what it means when it says "Kol Yisrael Arevim Ze Boze." They spoke no common language, shared no common culture, but they shared one thing, and that is the covenant of faith, the covenant that we all have something together. It is that which has sustained us to be the covenant of faith. Folks, thank you so much. Have a wonderful and meaningful day. I'm looking forward to continuing next week.